Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Today we have a real treat for you. We have a visit from a very august personage. In fact, several august personages joined us recently in nearby Bristol, Tennessee, to discuss a subject that, well, we've discussed before and that many people are discussing now, because the Supreme Court is currently considering the question of health care, the new federal health care law. We're waiting for a decision from the Supreme Court sometime in June of 2012. And in the meantime, we just couldn't leave it to the Supremes. We had to talk about it ourselves. And so the Appalachian School of Law teamed up with another local entity, the Wellmont Health System, a provider of health services here in this region of the country. And we sponsored, between the two of us, a forum, a public forum on health care. And at this forum, we assembled a doctor, we assembled a representative of the insurance industry, a representative of Wellmont itself, and then, of course, a couple of lawyers. You always have to have a couple of lawyers. We had my colleague, Doug McKechnie, from the Appalachian School of Law, who discussed several constitutional issues before the court. We had perhaps our most prominent person at the forum, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli of the Commonwealth of Virginia, a fellow who's not just important in our state, but who's gotten a national profile. And in great part because of his very vocal opposition to the health care statute. And finally, we had me. Now, I have to give you a word of explanation here, because normally speaking, you hear me in my objective role as a teacher, as a commentator. I always try to be as objective as I can and to present all sides of controversial issues. But this time, I was in the job I have during the day, the job of a constitutional law professor. And from time to time, I'm asked to come to these sorts of forums, or I'm asked to go on a radio show or a TV show or something and give my opinion. And that's exactly what I was asked to do this time. I was asked to give my opinion about the constitutionality of the Health Care Act. And without giving anything away, I'll simply tell you I was asked because my opinion contrasts with the Attorney General. At any rate, you'll get to listen to both sides. You get to listen to General Cuccinelli. You get to listen to me. You'll get to listen to my colleague, Doug McKechnie. And as always, you get to decide how you feel about these extremely important issues. And so the rest of our show will be a series of excerpts, just the good stuff from the recent healthcare forum. Let's start with the welcoming comments from Wellmont and the Appalachian School of Law.
I am Bart Hove. I'm the CEO here at Bristol Regional Medical Center, and this is not my hospital. This is our hospital. We appreciate, on behalf of the Wellmont Health System and Bristol Regional Medical Center, being able to host this educational and informative session in our fine Monarch Auditorium, and we really appreciate having a resource like this to be able to use for such an important purpose. At this point in time, I'd like to introduce Sandy McLaughlin, the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the Appalachian School of Law, another partner in this presentation today.
Good evening, and I would also like to welcome all of you here for this program. As you probably know, a lot of hours and effort were expended in planning this forum, and the Appalachian School of Law very much appreciates the generosity of Wellmont Health System in hosting this event here today. Now, I know that you are all familiar with Wellmont, but you may not be as familiar with the Appalachian School of Law. We're a private law school. We're located in Grundy, over in Buchanan County, Virginia, over across the mountain. We are fully accredited by the American Bar Association. We enrolled our first class in 1997, and on May the 5th this year, we will graduate our 13th class. So we're very proud of our institution and the students who have graduated and will be graduating from there. Now, our mission is primarily to provide legal education for those persons in the Appalachian region. But we also very much focus on community service, so much so that community service is actually a part of our curriculum. With Wellmont's focus being healthcare and the Appalachian School of Law's focus being legal education, it just seemed a natural fit for these two institutions to sponsor this event about community awareness. And I can tell you that the Appalachian School of Law is very proud to co-sponsor this event with Wellmont. Our goal this evening is to make this an educational opportunity for citizens to learn about the Affordable Health Care Act and its ramifications. And with the credentials of the panel members here tonight, I'm sure that when you leave, you will have a well-rounded insight into federal health care legislation. So thanks for coming tonight. If you're ever over in Grundy, we would love to have you as guest at the Appalachian School of Law.
The next voice you'll hear is that of David Bailey, the host of This Week in Richmond, a very important television show broadcast by our good friends at Blue Ridge PBS. David very kindly drove all the way out to Bristol so that he could moderate the evening's activities.
We're delighted to have this great panel back behind me and in front of you. You're going to hear about the history and the background. You're going to hear from our Attorney General in the Commonwealth of Virginia. You'll be hearing from professors at the Appalachian School of Law. And then you'll also be hearing from people from insurance and from the medical community. So it's a full-rounded academic program evening.
The next voice you'll hear is Judge Stephen McCullough of the Virginia Court of Appeals, who's going to give us some constitutional background. Just lay out the landscape for us so we can put everything in context.
What I'd like to do is basically to just set some background principles up that then some of our other panelists will develop a little bit more. What I've found over the years is that as I've talked to folks from all walks of life, that there's a profound reverence for our Constitution. But that profound reverence doesn't always go hand in hand with knowledge about what the constitutional structure is and what some of those specific provisions are. So that's my object, is to just give you the view from 20,000 feet, and then we'll develop that more with some of the other panelists. One of the critical things that animates this entire question is that the federal government is a government of limited enumerated powers. And so what that means is that any time Congress passes a law, any law, it has to be able to point to some power in the Constitution that allows it to do what it's doing. And this is different from what the states can do. The states have what lawyers call a police power. That is, they have broad general authority to regulate for the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of that state. For example, when a state requires you to go out and buy automobile insurance, it doesn't have to point to a specific power in the state constitution. It can just pass that law. And unless that law violates a tenet of the state constitution or the U.S. Constitution, well then the state is free, subject to those constraints, to do anything it wants. That's the first thing that differentiates the states from the federal government in terms of how they go about and the powers that they have. The specific powers that have really driven this debate in particular, and that form the basis for much of Congress's legislation in recent times, are found in Article 1, Section 8. If you turn to your Constitution, you'll see a whole laundry list of powers that say, here's what Congress can do. And so here are some of the specific powers. And by the way, the Constitution is not written in some mysterious, opaque language that only high priests who wear black robes can explain to everybody else. Everyone should be able to pick up their Constitution, read it in one sitting, and digest the gist of what the framers of that document set about to do. One of the central powers that Congress has is to regulate commerce with foreign nations, and here I'm reading from the text, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And the background to that was under the Articles of Confederation, which you may recall from your high school civics class, the states were trying to protect each other's industries and farms, And so they were passing things like tariff barriers and fees to punish commerce that came from other states. And of course, this was destructive to commerce and to prosperity. And so the idea was, by giving Congress this commerce power, Congress would be able to step in, regulate commerce, and suppress some of these regional jealousies and protections that were then in place. So that's a very important power. And it's one that, particularly since the New Deal, the U.S. Supreme Court has given a very, very broad construction to. Of course, during the Great Depression, many folks were unemployed. There was a huge, unprecedented economic crisis. Farms were being foreclosed on. And so the idea was, well, Congress needs to have the tools at its disposal to address in broad fashion the nature of commerce as it exists in the modern era. So that's one of the critical powers that Congress possesses.
Yes, thank you very much for that background. And our next presenter is our Attorney General. Those of us who are from the Commonwealth of Virginia and those of you in Tennessee, meet our Attorney General, Ken Cuccinelli. Ken, thanks so much for being here.
I'm more of a standing talker, so the judges sit while we stand, so that explains the delta here, the difference. I'm going to make some comments about the constitutional issues at stake, and obviously we can go into more as questions arise, but I'm going to, obviously, for those of you from Virginia, it might be obvious, for Tennessee, we were the first state to sue over the health care law, and so our perspective is that this is unconstitutional. That's the position we've taken. And I'm going to talk to you about the two arguments on constitutionality that the states have made. And both of these were argued 2 weeks ago in the Supreme Court, and now we await a ruling probably at the end of June. First thing to understand, the legislation, the health care legislation, the bill, is about health insurance and health care and 400 other things. The litigation, the lawsuit, is about liberty. Because the legal principles at stake in that case are absolutely not limited to health insurance or health care. And this was noted by justices from the bench in the Supreme Court. If Congress can order you to buy health insurance, they can order you, and what health insurance to buy, they can order you to buy a car, they can order you to buy asparagus, they can order you to buy a gym membership, to use the examples used by the judge in Richmond District Court in Virginia's case. Those are the legal principles that are at stake. And when Judge McCullough speaks of a government of limited and enumerated powers, Justice Scalia asked the lawyer for the federal government, what about those supposedly limited and enumerated powers? How is this in any way limited and enumerated? And the challenge for the federal government in this case, as they tried to defend the law, was to describe what real limit exists if this is constitutional. And it started right off the bat in the hearing on the individual mandate, the compulsion that you, as a citizen, buy the government-approved health insurance. Justice Kennedy asked the lawyer for the federal government, can you compel people into commerce in order to regulate them? Again, from Article 1, Section 8. Can you compel people into commerce so that you can use that power to regulate interstate commerce to govern that person's behavior? And the Solicitor General for the United States ducked. That's not what we're doing, Justice Kennedy. I would suggest if he asked the question, he probably thinks that is what they're doing. We'll find out in a few months. But this is an unprecedented exercise of power. Never in the history of this country has the federal government, under the guise of regulating commerce, ordered Americans to buy anything. And I would suggest to you that the reason they've never done this before is because every Congress before the last one and every president before this one knew they didn't have that power. In fact, Judge McCullough talked to you about the Articles of Confederation and the problems with commerce. I'll take you back before the Revolutionary War. In the 10 years we were boycotting British goods. Well, this was hurting the British. And there was a debate about whether or not this was treason. The Attorney General and Solicitor General for King George III sat in Parliament by tradition at that time and were asked, isn't this boycott treason? And the answer was no. The colonists have come close to the line, but not crossed it. Now think about that a moment. That's an acknowledgement by the government of Britain that we rebelled against, that they could not compel American subjects of the king to buy British goods. But the last Congress and this president think they can. That is how stark the historical uniqueness of this exercise of power is. It is truly unprecedented in scope. And as implied by the duck to the first question on the mandate, the federal government's challenge, as I said, was to articulate a limit to government power if this mandate is in fact constitutional. And they have been unable to do that. The Solicitor General tried to give some characteristics that make the healthcare / health insurance market that they were attempting to get at unique. And different justices kept giving examples. Well, you've just described, and the most amusing one was burial services by Justice Alito. Well, this could happen at any time unexpectedly. Well, you could die. And if you haven't accounted for the possibility yet, it's not cheap. It's thousands of dollars. Who's going to pay for that? Those costs get shifted, and the cost shifting was another argument. And those were the only two that he made. The only two that he made. We've been through over a dozen hearings at every level of court in the United States of America, and the federal government, in not one of them, succeeded in distinguishing what was unique about what they were trying to regulate. And they kept arguing the healthcare market, and Justice Scalia interrupted and said, you're not regulating healthcare. You're regulating insurance, which is quite correct. And their argument was, yes, but it's healthcare that's unique. The insurance addresses this unique market. And then the Chief Justice said, well, if you can do that because it's a unique market, there's a whole bunch of other ways to address it, and Justice Scalia then butted in. And when you answer that question, meaning the Chief Justice's question, I want you to address exercise. And what he meant by that was, if healthcare is unique and we can address it any of these different ways that affect this unique market, tell me what we can do with respect to exercise. Can we compel you to exercise? Can we check your exercise chart when you show up at the ER to decide whether we're going to treat you? Et cetera, et cetera. They never explained a unique element. Now, I'm going to, there was one other constitutional argument. It's a tougher one. It's on Medicaid, and I'll be quick with this one because it's short and not so sweet. The argument by the states from the Florida case, which is the one that was heard in the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago, was that the states are so ingratiated with the federal government in terms of Medicaid, health care assistance for the poor, that the massive increase in requirements on the states in their Medicaid programs amounts to unconstitutional coercion of the states. Now, there has never been a finding of unconstitutional coercion of the states, but if there was ever a case for a massive increase in spending in a voluntary program being coercion, this is it. And again, it's never happened before, but the Supreme Court has said it's possible. So on that one, we're in a we'll see, like much of the rest of it. Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we've just heard remarks from several people at the recent healthcare forum in Bristol, Tennessee. After the break, we'll have a little bit more from the forum, but of course, first we'll have our Constitutional quiz. Stay tuned.
Plant the seed in our home, and boys, let it grow where all can see. Feed it with our devotion, boys, call it the Liberty Tree. It's a tall old tree and a strong old tree. And we are the sons, yes, we are the sons of liberty. Save it from the storm, boys, water down its roots with tea. And the sun will always shine on the old Liberty Tree. It's a tall old tree.
Welcome to the quiz. Kelly Carmichael from James Madison's Montpelier.
Hello, Stuart. How are you?
I am doing so well. I think it's illegal in several states. And who do we have with us?
Nick Collegian.
Nick, where are you from?
Madison, Virginia.
Oh, Madison. You are close by me, my friend.
I am.
Excellent.
Where's Madison, Virginia compared to Orange, Virginia?
It is the neighboring county.
Our neighboring friend.
Wow. So we have an almost Montpelier. Have you been to James Madison's
this is an
Montpelier?
This is an important question, Nick. We may have to end the quiz right now.
No, I actually have not.
Okay.
Sorry.
Sorry, Nick.
Nick, you lose. Thanks for playing. You've got to go. It's like being from New York City and never having gone to the Statue of Liberty. I know.
Nick, when are you next back in Madison?
Either for Easter or for the start of summer break.
All right, you make sure that you come visit and come say hello to me.
I will.
You definitely have to do that. And
I will.
And it's worth your while. I'm telling you, it's worth your while. Okay, well, Kelly, do you have does everyone have his pen and paper ready? You got to get your pen and paper ready if you're listening in, because we got to keep these answer choices straight. All right, now, Kelly, do you have a question for Nick?
I do, Nick. Are you ready for a question on the 10th Amendment?
I am.
All right. Oh. Confidence. I like it.
You confident?
All right. The 10th Amendment, what does it do? Does it A, severely restricted the powers of the federal government, since it specified that Congress could only exercise those powers expressly delegated to it? B, radically change the meaning of the Constitution, since prior to its adoption, it was generally agreed that that Congress had unlimited powers? C, gave to the states an explicit right to nullify federal laws when Congress exceeded its constitutional boundaries, or D, made explicit what many Federalists had argued was already implicit, that powers not delegated to the federal government, nor prohibited to the state governments, were reserved to the states or the people.
Okay, now that was a mouthful.
About our 10th Amendment.
Very kind.
And a short amendment, too.
It's a short amendment, but I'll tell you what, it's a big one, and it's often been the subject of constitutional litigation. So let's go back over those. Let's read the question again, please, Kelly, and then let's just go by those answer choices one by one, please.
Sure thing. The 10th Amendment, A, severely restricted the powers of the federal government, since it specified that Congress could only exercise those powers expressly delegated to it.
What do you think about that one, Nick?
It sounds right, but I don't think it's the right answer.
It sounds right, but I'm curious. Why, if it sounds right, why don't you think it's the right answer?
Because it may have restricted the powers, but it wasn't the full scope of the 10th Amendment.
It wasn't the full. Oh, okay. So maybe not enough. All right. Well, let's go on to B and see if B is better.
All right, B. The 10th Amendment, did it radically change the meaning of the Constitution, since prior to its adoption, it was generally agreed that Congress had unlimited powers?
That was not correct, because under the Articles of Confederation, it was the states who had the powers, and Congress had very limited power under the Articles of Confederation. So I believe B is wrong.
But what about Congress within our Constitution?
Yeah, once Congress, I mean, we had the Constitution starting, you know, in 1789... was Congress's power unlimited prior to the adoption of the 10th Amendment a few years later in 1791?
No, because you had the checks and balances between the executive, judicial, and legislative branch.
Okay, so that answer choice goes too far in talking about powers of Congress. Okay, so we don't like B either, or Nick doesn't. Okay, what do you think? Kelly, let's see.
Nick, is the 10th Amendment, did it give states an explicit right to nullify federal laws when Congress exceeded its constitutional boundaries? We hear debates about that today.
Yeah.
I don't believe that one's correct either.
How come?
It doesn't seem right to me. I don't know quite why, but it just doesn't seem right to me.
So that word nullify might not be in there. All right, well, what about, I guess it better be D then, because he doesn't like any of these so far. What is D?
All right, sorry, let's see D. The 10th Amendment made explicit what many Federalists had argued was already implicit, that powers not delegated to the federal government nor prohibited to the state governments were reserved to the states or the people.
What do you think about that one?
I believe it's D.
You believe it's D.
Now, I believe it's D.
Why do you think it's D?
Because the 10th Amendment states that any powers not listed in this Constitution are delegated to the states, or given to the states. So I believe it's D.
Wow.
So this is just your memory. That's what you recall the 10th Amendment is saying. And so you're going to go on that basis, and you're going to choose answer choice D?
Yeah.
Final answer?
Yes, final answer.
Kelly, what about Nick's final answer?
All right, Nick, you redeemed yourself for not coming to visit us at James Madison's Montpelier with the correct response.
Yeah, I was actually kind of hoping he'd screw it up. Then we could have blamed it on his not going.
Exactly.
But nope. Nick, you messed us up here, because despite that terrible oversight of yours, you do know what the 10th Amendment says. In fact, I'm very impressed. You were able to almost recite it verbatim from memory. Here's the actual text of the 10th Amendment. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So it's essentially just saying, look, you know, we've given certain powers to the federal government in the Constitution, and we've also got a few provisions in that Constitution that say states can't do this and they can't do that. But other than those things, other than the stuff we've given to the federal government or prohibited to the states, well, everything else stays with the states. It's attempting to divide up how the Constitution divides federal and versus state power. Yep. And it's an ongoing debate, of course, within our constitutional history as to exactly where to draw that line. We call that the federalism debate. But that's what the 10th Amendment says, and you seem to have recalled it right out of thin air. So congratulations, you have won a T-shirt.
Well done,
all right.
Nick.
Thank you.
Very well done.
Come visit us at Montpelier.
I will. I will make sure I come this summer.
And
all right.
Ask for Kelly.
Yes.
I will.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where our topic this week is healthcare, and we've been listening to a forum on that subject recently held in Bristol, Tennessee. Now, the last person you heard was Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli of the Commonwealth of Virginia, an outspoken opponent of the Health Care Act. Next, you're going to hear a familiar voice. It's actually my voice, but in an unfamiliar role. I was asked to go and give a contrasting opinion to General Cuccinelli. And here it is.
Thank you very much. Our next two presenters are from the Appalachian School of Law. The first is Dr. Stuart Harris.
Good evening. I'm going to stand up too, but for a different reason. It's the only time that I feel taller than the Attorney General. I'll echo the sentiments I've already heard about how happy I am to see you all here this evening, especially to talk about our Constitution, and of course about an important subject like health care. But I have to wonder at some of the conversations. I've been sitting here imagining the conversations that took place earlier today in some of your houses. It's something like this. Honey, you feel like going to a movie tonight? Nah. Well, let's watch TV. Nah. I know. Let's go to a forum on healthcare. And here you all are. I'm going to respectfully disagree with the Attorney General with regard to the individual mandate. My colleague, Doug McKechnie, is going to talk about Medicaid and some of the other issues. And my argument really kind of boils down to this. That horse done left the barn. Healthcare, as Justice Kennedy did note during the oral argument, and he is the swing vote on the Supreme Court in all likelihood, he noted that healthcare is unique. And here's how it's unique. At least as far back as 1986, the federal government has mandated that people like Bart and people who run this hospital and other hospitals all across the United States have to provide you health care. Many states have similar statutes. In other words, if you have a heart attack right here tonight in this auditorium, this hospital has to take you to the emergency room and has to treat you, at least to the point where you get stabilized, whether you can pay or not. That's the mandate. We as a society have decided, and you can agree with this or disagree with it, but we've already decided years ago that we're not going to leave people to die in the streets. We're not going to leave them on the front door of the hospital and not treat them. So someone's paying for that care. Who's paying for it? You are, and I am. If you have health insurance, as I do, I'm paying, according to most estimates I've seen, about $1,000 a year for people who, for whatever reason, don't pay for their health care. Now, some of those people are truly poor, and I feel sorry for them. God bless them. Some people are just freeloaders. They don't want to pay for health insurance, even though at any moment they could have a heart attack or a motorcycle accident or whatever else it might be. So you and I are going to pay. That's roughly 17% of the GDP in this country that we spend on health care, and a very significant portion of it is us paying for other people's health insurance or for their health care because they don't have health insurance. So half the market is already regulated by the federal government, and all the federal government is doing with this individual mandate is regulating the other half. It's saying somebody's got to pay for this, and at least if you can't afford it, at least if you have no religious reluctance to buy health insurance, then by golly, you should pay for it. You can't get health insurance when you walk into the emergency room. You have to pay for it in advance or it doesn't work. And that's why the Obama administration is calling this the individual responsibility mandate. I think of it as the anti-freeloader statute. The Commerce Clause, which is the clause of the Constitution that most people think governs this circumstance, allows Congress to regulate anything that substantially affects commerce. 17% of the GDP, $1,000 a year from each of us to pay for people who are uninsured, that's a substantial effect on the economy. So I not only think that this is constitutional, I think that it's clearly constitutional. Now let me hasten to add, I'm not talking about the policy behind it. I'm not saying this is the best way to address health care or the worst way. No doubt we could come up with better solutions if we had long enough and could think about it hard enough. Maybe you've got some ideas on better ways, but the question is whether Congress has the power to regulate one of the biggest parts of our economy in a way to simply make people pay for what they consume. Now, General Cuccinelli, as did several justices on the Supreme Court, drew an analogy, asked about gym memberships. Well, if the federal government mandated that every gym had to give us free memberships, well, yeah, then the federal government could also mandate we have to pay for it. If the federal government mandated that farmers had to give us asparagus, whether we could pay or not, well, then, yeah, the federal government could also mandate we have to pay for that asparagus. But the federal government hasn't done those things because health care is pretty much unique. Burial? Well, if the federal government mandated that we all got to have a fancy funeral with a fancy casket and flowers, then, yeah, they could mandate we have to pay for funeral insurance. As it happens, relatively few people have to get buried by the government and they don't get fancy funerals. So that analogy sort of fails as well. All this is regulating the economy, regulating commerce that crosses state lines. It's not merely constitutional, it's clearly constitutional. Thank you.
Thank you. And now, Dr. Doug McKechnie.
Good evening, everyone. If Stewart and General Cuccinelli were tasked with talking about the interesting thing about the Affordable Health Care Act, I'm tasked with talking about what the equivalent of paint drying. So I'm going to talk about the first day of oral argument and the third day of oral argument. The first day of oral argument deals with a constitutional concept called jurisdiction. And what that means is that federal courts cannot hear cases unless something in the Constitution tells them that they can hear a case or Congress has given them the power to hear a particular case. And what I'm talking about is something called the Anti-Injunction Act. And what the Anti-Injunction Act says, it's a little over 100 years old, and what it says is that you can't sue the government about a tax before you've actually paid the tax. And why would that be the case? Well, think from a public policy perspective, the federal government wants that money, right? They want you to pay your tax, and if you think that that tax was either illegal or unconstitutional, then you go through some kind of administrative process, sue the government after you've paid the tax, and try to get that refunded to you. And so the idea is that if this Anti-Injunction Act, this act that's about 100 years old, if it is in fact jurisdictional, the courts can't even hear your case before you pay the tax. And why does that matter? Well, no one's paid if in fact the individual mandate and the penalty that goes along with it, if in fact it is a tax, then the Supreme Court can't even hear this case. The case is too early. We have to wait until people actually pay that penalty and go through the administrative process through the tax code, and that won't happen until 2014. So there's this jurisdictional question with regard to the Constitution and what's called the Anti-Injunction Act. That was on the first day of oral argument. The third day of oral argument, there were two other constitutional questions that were presented. One of the questions was whether or not this act, this individual mandate, is severable. If the individual mandate is unconstitutional, is that severable? Can that be taken out of the act? Does the rest of the act stand, even though this individual mandate has been taken out? And the reason that's constitutional is that's kind of a separation of powers issue, right? The idea is that Congress passes the laws, and the Supreme Court and courts below the Supreme Court interpret the laws. And the idea behind severability and approaching severability questions conservatively is we don't want the courts kind of second-guessing Congress and legislatures. And so to the extent possible, they want to be conservative. They want to make sure that they're trying to not undermine the democratic will of the people and trying to preserve as much of a statute as is possible. And so that's kind of the question. One of the questions is if the individual mandate is in fact unconstitutional, how much of the act will remain, how much of the act can stand, and how much of it will go away, if at all. And finally, Attorney General Cuccinelli mentioned this idea of Medicaid. The idea is that how much real power does the federal government have with regard to its spending power? And that's kind of a constitutional issue as well. The federal government gives money to the states for Medicaid, and it occasionally changes the requirements that the states have to meet to get that money. And the question, as Attorney General Cuccinelli properly phrased it or kind of crafted it, was the question before the court was, can the federal government now come in and say, through the Affordable Health Care Act, you're going to have new requirements for Medicaid, you're going to have to cover more people with regard to Medicaid, and if you decide not to, we're not going to give you that Medicaid money anymore. Can the federal government do that through its spending power? And so that kind of frames those, for lack of a better term, kind of generic and dry issues that I've been kind of tasked with discussing.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about healthcare and listening to some excerpts from a recent forum on healthcare held at the Bristol Regional Medical Center in Bristol, Tennessee. After the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll finish our excerpts from the healthcare forum. Stay tuned. Well, Kelly Carmichael from the Center for the Constitution, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
This week at Montpelier, on Saturday, May 12th, we are actually going to start our weekly enslaved community tour. in addition to three generations of Madison, James Madison, we talk about the Madison so often, Montpelier was also home to a community of enslaved families.
Yes, it was.
And this nearly 100 enslaved people lived at Montpelier during Madison's time. So this will be a chance to explore plantation life at Montpelier, including the lives of several known enslaved communities, individuals at Montpelier.
Well, I really want to applaud you all. I've spoken to Matt Reeves about this and Tom Chapman as well. And slavery is a sad, sad episode in our constitutional history, but it's very important, and it's very important to see the homes of the founders, like Montpelier, saying, you know, this is what happened, and paying more attention to what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard. You can't talk about the Constitution and the rights that the Constitution gave and the protections that the Constitution gave if you're not also talking about how it didn't protect a vast majority of people at the founding.
And so you guys, essentially, is this showing what you've learned through your archaeology?
It's some of the archaeology, but it's also examining, you know, Madison's attitudes towards the institution of slavery. And part of the tour will walk you through the mansion basement or sites of slave dwellings and the detached kitchen where a lot of the domestic slaves would work and the blacksmith shop in Mount Pleasant, which is the original Madison family settlement at Montpelier. And the slave cemetery.
Okay, and how can people find out more about this, information?
Absolutely. You can go to montpelier.org, and the tour begins on Saturday, May 12th at 1 p.m.
Great, and there will be subsequent tours as well?
Yep, every Saturday.
Tremendous. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're listening to excerpts from a recent forum on the new health care law held at the Bristol Regional Medical Center in Bristol, Tennessee. Now, we've heard from the lawyers, including me. Let's hear from some real people.
We turn from the attorneys this time to hear from some other panelists. And Diane Boyle is next from the insurance perspective.
Thank you. I'll stand as well because apparently we started a trend here. And I can stretch and then that way I'll stay awake a little bit. The shift, as you mentioned, I'm going to shift our focus. I come from an organization that represents insurance agents and brokers. Those are the individuals that help consumers make their decision about what insurance coverage they might need. And when you started this discussion about health care reform a few years ago, we were very active in saying that reform needed to happen. And we had two basic tenets that needed to be addressed. You needed to look at access and you needed to look at affordability. And we didn't believe that you could separate the two. Because when you ask people, why don't you have insurance coverage, the answer generally came back that it was unaffordable. So if you made it more affordable, you would address a large part of that access issue. And what we saw with the ACA was that the focus was really more on not only access, but a mandate that you have that. We don't have a position on whether it's going to turn out to be constitutional or not constitutional, whether this individual mandate will hold or not hold. What we do know in this sea of uncertainty is that it's going to continue to evolve. Because if you have this individual mandate stricken down, yet the rest of the law remains in effect, there's something in the law now that's guarantee issue and community rating, which means at any time you can come in sick or injured, and we have to provide you coverage. So if you take the individual mandate away, what is the incentive? And I had this discussion with my husband, thank goodness for C-SPAN, because I could watch a lot of the debate at home. And it was about 2 in the morning, and the Senate was talking about it. And I turned to him, and I said, you know what? If this goes through, we're not carrying coverage. And he said, what do you mean? We have 3 young boys. And he said, what if one of the boys gets sick? And I said, I'll buy coverage then. And he said, well, will you be able to get coverage then? And I said, yes, it's a guaranteed issue. I can't be denied. It's going to be really expensive, but that's when I'm going to get it, and I'm not going to be alone. And that's going to create a system that's it's going to create a market that's not stable, and you want to have a stable insurance market. And so our biggest concern is if the individual mandate is ruled unconstitutional, yet it isn't severed from, or it is severed from the rest of the law, then you're going to have this market that really doesn't work.
Thank you. We will hear from 2 healthcare providers, from the hospital systems and then from the physician, Denny D. Navarez.
So we have this federal mandate that says if you come into anybody's emergency room, and it's and you have a need, you must be treated. And you must be treated to be stabilized, and you must have follow-up care. So you can't simply treat that particular issue, send somebody back out in the streets. We also have litigation that can follow us as well if that's not done properly. So the fact of the matter is we have a system right now that not only is it broken financially, it's also setting us up for the very people that we want to give access to be the people that get the least access. Because if you're a hospital system, as we are and as are many, that are living on a 2% margin, and I'd venture to say most businesses are not living on a 2% margin, that inability to understand how reimbursement is going to be affected and what we're going to cut puts very much at risk the most vulnerable of our populations. And I'll share this with you. We're here in a lovely spot here in Bristol. We have a Holston Valley as part of the Wellmont system down the street. There is enough population there to help those facilities do well. But I can also take you out to a hospital we have called Hancock, which has 10 beds in a very rural setting, and they lose a lot of money. They are part of our mission, and you never see the mission delivered better than when you go to one of those facilities. You have one emergency room physician, you have two nurses, and they are caring for a community that often, if we were not there, that person that's in a motorcycle accident or a car accident would simply not be able to get to the next nearest hospital in time for that to not be life-threatening or damaging. So the very things that we fear in healthcare is not that we won't make the changes that we need to make in the care model. Matter of fact, we're making them irrespective of what comes down, because we know to do what's right, we've got to find better ways to keep bending the cost curve. We're going to have to do that anyway. So we're doing a lot of things to try to make healthcare much more affordable in an age and a stage where our population is aging and chronic diseases are more prevalent. So we're going to have to work harder on creating wellness as an agenda and not just illness and treatment. And we know that, and we are doing some of that. Hopefully, irrespective of what comes down the pike, we will change that cost curve. But what I most fear is that to be able to maintain a margin and stay in business as an industry, some of the most vulnerable will be sacrificed. The other piece that I would add from a provider point of view is, you know, this is not a light switch that you can get ready for overnight. So we have a lot of folks that have put a lot of time and effort and infrastructure and cost into the preparedness of this bill without any knowledge that it's going to stay in the fashion that it is. Matter of fact, almost perfect knowledge that it won't stay in the fashion that it is. So there's a tremendous cost right now that's going out that's adding no value at the bedside whatsoever to the patient, just to try to prepare for the unknown. So the lack of clarity has added cost in a time where the whole debate is about how to reduce the healthcare cost. And that is very traditional within what I see to be a very highly regulated industry. There's a lot of times where the regulation, there is no line of sight as to exactly how that helped us to provide better quality of care at the bedside.
Yeah. There's no legislator up here. I was a state senator. There's two of them, Phil Puckett here and Bill Carrico here. But I'm going to offer a legislative comment that Congressman Rowe and I mentioned beforehand, and that is, if, as I hope, this whole thing goes, it would be awfully helpful, consistent with comments I heard over here, I forget which one of you mentioned it, to have a series of, relatively speaking, simple bills than one monster that we've got to try and digest. And I would say in Virginia, 99.9% of our bills are 4 pages or less, you know? And federal government, they couldn't possibly achieve that. They couldn't pass a bill that was only 4 pages. But there are a series of things that everyone recognizes and agrees need to be addressed, and there's a series of ways that, without partisan lineups, many of them could be addressed. And yet there seems to be this compulsion on the part of both Republican and Democrat leaderships to roll everything. They must log roll. They must roll crud in with the good stuff. And that really needs to be resisted if we're actually going to take decent shots, because I agree with the comment earlier, there is no silver bullet for this system.
Thank you. Dr. Blackwell?
You know, I like the precedent of sitting down here, so I'm not going to preach to anybody here, and plus I'm going to keep my comments very brief. Really, I'm the token. You know, every panel's got to have a token member, and I'm the token member. And, you know, all of this discussion on the legal side of it, you had to have one doc, because this is really where the rubber meets the road. And I'm very pleased and honored, in fact, to be sitting here to give you my perspective on it. Now, of course, I don't represent the entire House of Medicine, but I do represent a number of folks in the specialty of cardiovascular diseases, and spend a lot of time at the national level discussing this topic and talking with other folks about it. And the notion that you're going to provide unfettered access to our current healthcare system is just simply incorrect. It's not possible. And what folks are going to quickly be educated about is the difference between access and availability. And that is that you can provide, you can say everything's free, provide unlimited access. Who's going to provide the care? The providers are not going to be available for that. It's just something that, again, I think has taken a very complicated topic and oversimplified it. A couple other things I'd like to say. First of all, I'm not aware of a single physician. I talk to lots of docs. I'm not aware of a single physician that doesn't think that something needs to occur. It's just that, again, I think the cart may be ahead of the horse here a little bit. We need to do some things, but what's being proposed right now, I'm afraid, is going to take a difficult situation and make it even more difficult.
It's your weekly constitutional, and we're getting healthy, or at least we're talking about getting healthy, with a bunch of people at the recent forum on healthcare held at the Bristol Regional Medical Center in Bristol, Tennessee. Now let's take a moment and do a Madison Minute.
We tend to think of James Madison as the father of the Constitution, and appropriately so. But sometimes we focus so much on his constitutional contributions that we forget that he also served in several elected offices, most notably as the fourth president of the United States. Madison's public life spanned decades and included years of service in both the Virginia and national legislatures. Indeed, it is sometimes said that Madison was one of America's first professional politicians. He never held a job outside of the public eye. With his close friend and political ally, Thomas Jefferson, Madison founded one of America's first political parties. But in true political fashion, the two men had to compromise on the party's name. Madison thought they should be called Republicans. Jefferson preferred Democrats. The party was eventually called the Democratic Republicans. At first, most people shortened the name to Republicans, but the Republican Party of Madison and Jefferson is unrelated to the Republican Party of today. In fact, Madison's and Jefferson's Republicans are now considered the forerunner of today's Democrats, thanks to President Andrew Jackson, who started using that more populist name several decades later. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we're wrapping up our discussion of healthcare and the recent healthcare forum at the Bristol Regional Medical Center. Let's have a couple of questions and answers that were submitted by the audience and answered by our panel of healthcare experts and lawyers.
Okay, I'd like to thank the panel and to say that we've had submitted at least two dozen questions, and we'll get to as many of those as we can in the next 25 minutes, and then we'll open it up for the reception time and individual questions. The first question, and might I ask the panel, if two or three of you want to answer, that's fine. Keep your answers short, and then we'll get to more questions. First question, how do you distinguish the uninsured motorist fee in Virginia and the mandate that Virginia can make me pay a fee if I don't have car insurance? How does that relate? Anyone?
Yes.
Going back to Judge McCullough's comments about the difference between state power and federal power, let's make a more direct apples-to-apples comparison. Massachusetts has ordered its citizens to buy health insurance. It is a state, and it has the constitutional authority to do that. Because remember, all the powers not given to the federal government remain with the states and the people. And Massachusetts exercised that residual power to order its citizens to buy health insurance. The same would go for auto insurance and a variety of other things. But the states have this power. The federal government does not have this power.
Anyone else?
Well, believe it or not, I actually agree with the Attorney General completely on this, and with Judge McCullough, that he's exactly right. States have broad police power. Federal government has enumerated powers, but I will make this other related point. States, all of them, as far as I know, mandate that we all have to have insurance for our cars. So I imagine most of you have car insurance. Do you feel less free because of that? Do you feel that infringes on your liberty? I just feel that's something that responsible people should do, and I'm happy to do it. And I guess that informs a lot of my opinion about the health insurance mandate. I realize the constitutional difference, but I respectfully disagree with those who say that it's a significant infringement on our liberty to have an individual mandate at a federal level.
What you just heard is accepting the sacrifice of liberty to get the auto insurance to drive in the state. And that's fine. That's a decision that I think he's probably correctly made with respect to everybody in here. But don't think there is no cost in freedom and in liberty. You're being dictated to, and you're accepting that. Now, there's a path of accountability within state government. It's unelecting people. But that doesn't mean you aren't giving up some degree of your freedom and some degree of your liberty to accept that, or even have it taken from you legitimately, constitutionally is what I mean by legitimately, by the state as it legitimately makes the decision, we are going to reduce our citizens' freedom of choices, liberty, in order to, as a prerequisite to give them a driver's license, so that insurance will be provided in the event of, say, an uninsured motorist situation. Just in part we agree, and in part we disagree. There is a cost in liberty. And the question is it too high? And the answer to that question for different citizens is yes or no, and for different issues.
Okay, shifting to another subject, and there are quite a few others that are listed. Do you think the Supreme Court will refrain from using this case to exercise judicial activism?
I think the phrase judicial activism is the eye of the beholder, really, is what it is. And I think it boils down to where you read the constitutional tea leaves and where you come down. If it's a decision you like, you say, well, by golly, they got it right. The wisdom from the court is wonderful. And if they rule the way you don't like, you say it's activism. And so, I think the phrase judicial activism is generally unhelpful. Really, the questions that should be asked are, how far do Congress's limited enumerated powers go? Because the power of judicial review, that is the power that the courts have to strike down laws that conflict with the Constitution, has been the case for a long, long time, and no one questions that power. So to me, that's the relevant inquiry is, where are the limits to Congress's power, not the label we affix to decisions we like or don't like?
And as so often is the case, the judge gets the last word. There are a number of people I need to thank this time around because so many people worked on this health care forum. I'll just go ahead and start with David Bailey, the host of This Week in Richmond from Blue Ridge PBS. He was our moderator this evening, and he did a wonderful job. From Wellmont Health System, I'd like to thank Ben Hove, Denny DeNarvez, Dr. Jerry Blackwell, Jim Wozniak, the media relations coordinator who was so helpful through the process. From the Appalachian School of Law, Doug McKechnie and Sandy McLaughlin. And of course, Diane Boyle from the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. Of course, we can't overlook Judge Stephen McCullough of the Virginia Court of Appeals. And last but certainly not least, our marquee presenter, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli from the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I want to thank General Cuccinelli not just for participating in the forum, but for traveling all the way up to Grundy, Virginia the next day and coming to speak to my constitutional law class, speaking to the law school at large. He spent hours with us, and it was great fun and very enlightening for all. My name is Stuart Harris. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. And remember, it's your constitution, and you need to learn about it.